Hey folks, my name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual and hormonal health, and I have a very special guest with us today on today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. I have Adam Gavilli, and Adam is a pelvic floor physical therapist in New York City. Adam, say hello to the crew.
Hello, everybody. How's it going?
So Adam and I met through LinkedIn. He sent a wonderful networking message, which I think is great to work to reach out to people within the field that are out of your specialty. And I responded because I'm always trying to expand my network. And interestingly, like the following week that you reached out and we had set up a meeting, I actually saw a patient from New York City who I identified as having very obvious pelvic floor dysfunction. And I was like, this is perfect because I just connected.
What were the obvious dysfunctions?
Yeah, I have to look them up. I don't recall, but it's usually all the urinary symptoms.
Sure.
See frequency, I think some post-void dribbling, you know, stuff like that.
At the time, intuitively, you're like, this is definitely a pelvic floor issue.
Yeah, it was so obvious. It was so obvious. So I want to begin by talking a little bit about your history, right? You're a man with pelvic floor dysfunction.
No, not currently.
But you used to have pelvic floor dysfunction.
For sure. And so from the ages of like 19 to 25, about 6 years, I went through a pelvic floor dysfunction, which included urinary frequency, urgency. I was going, I was peeing probably 20 times a day, constipation at times, not so much ED, but like some sort of premature ejaculation that would fluctuate. And I would go to my PCP. My PCP referred me to a urologist. That urologist couldn't help me. I think I saw a total of 6 urologists. I've done 3 cystoscopies. It ran the gamut of tests, obviously. MRIs, uroflows. I was on uroxetrol, first generation antidepressants for the pain that they call it. I told them I had no pain. Neurotriptyline, amitriptyline. What is it? The fluoroquinolone, Cipro, Levaquin, all the good stuff. Yeah. And it kind of got me nowhere. I even got seen by Trump's urologist. And I'm like, this lady is going to. Philippa Cheatham, who's an amazing clinician, what she did was a little outside the box. She's like, we're going to do semen testing or semen culture. And we did find something. And I was like, this is it. We found, I think I told you this before, Enterococcus faecalis. And I was like, wow, we found a bacteria. I'll just take the antibiotic that treats this. And nothing resulted from taking the antibiotic. So I hadn't heard of pelvic floor dysfunction. I got treated. It took me 4 pelvic floor therapists and the last one got me better. And then I was like, okay, why are there no men treating this? Like, I'm talking about penis stuff to a woman. Now, many women can be really knowledgeable about penis and all the good stuff about male genitalia, but there's a disconnect. You don't have the same parts. And so as knowledgeable as you can be, there was that disconnect. I wanted to kind of fill that gap. So that's why we do what we do today.
Oh my God. There were so many things that I want to ask you about based on what you just said. So let's rewind a little bit. You said, and then you finally saw a pelvic physical therapist, or you found out about a pelvic physical therapist. How did you find out?
Great question. So I think it was a friend of mine that said that was working in a clinic that had, like, I think he was, just volunteering at a physical therapy clinic that had a pelvic floor therapist. She was really open in regards to speaking about it. And I didn't go to that clinic. I went to a hospital-based system out in Long Island. I was living in Queens at the time. Dr. Robert Moldrin, who works for, I believe, Northwell Health, if that's still it, he's like at the forefront of everything and anything pelvic floor from a urology standpoint. So he had a pelvic floor therapist at the hospital. Now, if you could imagine doing pelvic floor therapy at a hospital, I mean, like, yeah, everything with like these blue walls, white walls, I kind of felt like it was cold. I felt like I was on a surgical table. I didn't get better. I think where pelvic floor was back in the day, we didn't have as much information. We were kind of just like still treating men like they did women. And that didn't translate. So I didn't see any results from that. And from there, I just kind of found more pelvic floor therapists and saw what I need and found the right one.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So you saw the first pelvic physical therapist. You didn't get better. What made you think, I still think this could be a problem with my pelvic floor, but maybe I need to see someone else because I imagine that many people would see a specialist, not get better, and say, well, then it must not be my pelvic floor.
I mean, look, one of the questions I even ask my patients is intuitively, what do you feel that this is? And I don't care if you have a medical background or if you're just, if you work in sanitation, it's irrelevant. You live in your body, you know what this could be. And so, given I've had all the objective imaging and the testing, all of that was inconclusive. And this felt like there was some sort of correlation to, movement and muscular tightness. And I was like, let's stick to this. And I'm not a guy that gives up really easy. I mean, sure, there were points of despair. I was like, this freaking sucks, obviously. But it got to the point I was like, intuitively, I know that this is not something that can be treated from, I guess, the medical standpoint, from medication and whatnot. So I
Yeah.
thought to myself,
Yeah. I see so many patients, like you go through like this million-dollar workup and you keep getting told everything is normal, which I think for some people that's very irritating and it's very frustrating because they don't feel normal, right? And so the reality is a lot of the imaging and testing that we're doing is not going to pick up on the musculoskeletal functional component, right? So I think we have to be clear with our patients what this test can and cannot see. So
definitely.
let me go back to the four different pelvic physical therapists because I think this is a really important point. What was similar and different between the strategies with each pelvic PT?
It's the same problem I see with a lot of the pelvic floor therapists nowadays. Now, don't get me wrong, if this goes viral and a lot of people hear me talking, there are many great clinicians out there, both urologists and pelvic floor therapists. I'm not only coming to you as a patient, but as a clinician. And so I'm marrying the two. And so when I talk about kind of like the criticisms I have towards the profession that I'm in, it's maybe a small part of the profession. Nonetheless, this is what I experienced. A lot of how these pelvic floor therapists are taught in the construct of female pelvic floor therapy and kind of like, let's translate that to men. That doesn't work. And that's what I felt was the biggest disconnect when I was getting treated for it. And so, and then on top of that, just like people like to talk about parasympathetic and sympathetic, but I don't think anybody knows what the hell that means. They're like, the whole point of pelvic floor therapy is we have a group of muscles that no one knows how to use. And I'm not saying you need to volitionally know how to use these muscles, but after surgery, if I get someone post-op ACL, their quad shuts off due to the inflammatory mechanisms around the knee, I have to teach them how to reuse that muscle. This is no different than me teaching someone how to use their pelvic floor. Okay. And I think people saw pelvic floor therapy almost like different than regular orthopedic physical therapy. And it's kind of the same. And how do we meet the patient in the middle? And this is all patient-centered care. Every patient is different. You're going to have to speak to them differently. You're going to have to give them different cues. So I think this is one of the beautiful parts of pelvic floor therapy and not, but like, and in medicine, you have clinical prediction rules and kind of some sort of guideline to go through. Pelvic floor therapy doesn't really have that yet. And I don't even know if you can get there. So I went off on a tangent a bit, but you get what I'm trying to say.
We like the tangents. So you are a male pelvic physical therapist helping men with pelvic floor dysfunction. And I think there's so much value in a treating healthcare provider having some sort of shared experience with our patients.
Sure.
With that being said, I think there's a lot of power in someone being so incredibly different from the patient. When I look back at sort of my training and a lot of my expertise, I'm a woman treating men, and I'm a woman who's treated a lot of transgender patients. And I've only started treating my cisgendered female patients because they kept asking for help. And I kept saying, I can't help them. And then I was like, wait a second. If I can help these two other groups of people, I think I can help my fellow ladies because
Sure.
of that shared experience. So I think what I love is that we all kind of have a place in this, and it just kind of depends. We hope that our patients can find a provider with whom they feel comfortable.
Right.
And perhaps that's the role of just having like a diversified healthcare workforce.
Yeah, I think that's 70% of the battle when finding a provider, right? You want someone that you connect with, someone that can really understand where you're coming from. And majority of our patients, I mean, you've probably experienced this, will probably tell you that they've been gaslit from one or two providers within their, I guess, continuity of care, if I can say that. So how do we, by the time I see a patient, they've probably seen five or six providers like I have. And all they've got is hope and despair along that line, along that spectrum. And in my evaluation, my point here is just to make sure that you know that I've heard you, that everything you're feeling is legit. Not in some toxic positivity way, but like, first of all, if I feel like I can't help you, I'll let you know that. But just to know that there's a way out. And the usage of like the verbiage that people use, chronic, and some of the stuff you find online is really not helpful to someone going through this for X amount of time. So as a clinician, my point is to make people feel comfortable, to tone down your nervous system, both physically and mentally.
So you mentioned, I feel like this topic, there's like two words that I've brought up in conversations before that are so incredibly like polarizing and really spark some heated conversations. It's whenever you're talking to a man and you bring up the term narcissist, and it's when you bring up the term gaslighting. And I feel like everyone with whom you bring up those terms are like, well, define what that means, you know? So when you mention gaslighting in healthcare, in the pelvic floor field, what might that look like for someone?
You mean if I speak to a patient about it,
Yeah, like if
or
a patient, like that scenario where like someone is being like, you know, gaslit in the healthcare office when he's coming in and really struggling with pelvic floor symptoms, would it be the healthcare provider saying, it's all in your head?
yeah, and maybe to say it's all in your head has some merit, but the truth is, I mean, it's much deeper than that. But I think a lot of providers nowadays are seeing 60 patients a day. They don't care to really listen to you. They don't have time. They don't see this as a serious problem. And so I think maybe they've read one or two articles to show some sort of correlation to anxiety and pelvic floor issues, and they just chalk it up to that. But the truth is, if I speak to any male and anything's going on with their nether region, so to speak, wouldn't you be anxious too? Like that's how most men define who they are, like how well they could have sex. And the fact is, like, peeing and pooping is just such an important part of our day. Like, that's how we evacuate the toxins in our body. And it feels good to relieve yourself. If you can't do any of that, now you can't have sex, can't get an erection, you can't pee or poop correctly. That's going to affect you immensely. So a provider has to notice that. So most of these guys just talk about how it's mostly older providers that just probably read one or two papers, or maybe went to a conference that saw some sort of correlation between anxiety and pelvic floor issues.
And we know that they definitely go hand in hand. And I explain it like this with my patients is I would never tell someone that it's all in his or her head, but it might be in their brain.
Sure.
You know, and we always try to separate the mind or the brain from the body. But last time I checked, like the only way to separate those two is to literally cut off someone's head. Of course they're connected. Of course there is a connection.
Of course. That's
So you're in New York City. And
right.
I know you were part of a recent article, you know, with the question of like, does every financial man in New York City have pelvic floor dysfunction? So my question for you, Adam, is does every man in finance in New York City have pelvic floor dysfunction?
No, and it's funny because when I spoke to the writer of that article, I guess you have to find some sort of connection in order, or you have to find a premise in order to write about it. But I guess in efforts to get the word out, yes, it's fine. But no, when I first started treating, I used to think everyone on my table was type A because that's what the current research showed. The truth is, I get a lot of type B guys who have issues with their pelvic floor dysfunction. This is just a coordination issue. You don't know how to work these muscles. So are there men that carry tension in their pelvic floor when they're stressed? Sure. Just like there are people who carry tension in their upper trap and they kind of kink their neck when they're stressed. So correlation doesn't equal causation always. We know that. But yes, if you're constantly tensioning your pelvic floor, you're gonna have issues, right? But I don't know if there's a direct correlation there.
All right, so we shouldn't change the song. What is it? 6'5", Blue Eyes, Trust Fund, Pelvic Floor Dysfunction.
There you go. There you go.
That's not gonna
Exactly.
be something that we add.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you'd ever want to date a guy that had a trust fund, but then like didn't take care of his pelvic floor, because then you're not meeting some of your needs. So yeah.
So, who are the types of guys that you see in your clinic?
Everyone and anyone. I think is a huge misconception. You just think that stressed out guys or high functioning guys, I'm seeing probably the chillest guy on my table who has a pelvic floor dysfunction. I am just teaching you how to reuse those muscles. I do not want to see you forever. I mean, there are some men that I see for 6 to 8 sessions, some we see for a couple months. It's all at their discretion. And everyone and anyone. I mean, if there's one thing we get from this podcast interview, it's everyone comes here. The average age is probably 20 to 45. So this is very much a young man's issue. And then, of course, probably 58 and up would be the post-prostatectomy crowd. But other than that, we see mostly young males here. And it's funny because the guys that come in that are in their 50s that are between that age gap, I usually tell them this is very much a young man's issue. So, like, you're a young guy, and they love hearing that.
You got to feed their ego a little bit.
I
So,
mean, y'all need it, yeah.
what are the types of symptoms they would present with where you're like, this is so obvious that it's a pelvic floor dysfunction issue?
Yeah, so some patients come in with one or two of these symptoms, some come with all, but generally urinary frequency or urgency, some form of erectile dysfunction, maybe premature ejaculation, groin pain, hard flaccid, which is when the penis is shortened and retracted and almost looks hard in a flaccid state, constipation, shooting pain into the rectum,
Do you get like tip of penis pain?
tip of penis pain is huge. Yeah, of course. Urethral burning, right? Which we could talk about why that happens. Yeah, anything and anything in that area. So I usually always take a call and I'm like, let's figure this out.
It's so crazy, like all those symptoms, because when I was working at the University of Iowa, this is where I really developed an appreciation for what pelvic physical therapists could do for my patients. And I remember reaching out to each of the four pelvic PTs, and I sat down with each of them and I said, Amy, who can you help me with? Natalie, who can you help me with? And they described all of the symptoms that you're talking about, which is otherwise the bane of every urologist's existence.
And why do you
You
see
see
that?
all of these symptoms, you're like, but I can help those guys. And so when I look back at my time at the University of Iowa, I think one of the biggest contributions that I made was educating my peers and colleagues that they should not feel bad about referring to pelvic physical therapy. This is the life you've chosen, right? So if a guy has tip of penis pain, are you saying you can help that guy?
Without question. Without question. Now, of course, like, I work with urologists. Like, I want to make sure that there isn't something further that we're missing. Yeah. There was one case, and if I'm being honest and totally vulnerable here, I'm very good at what we do. We're very good at what we do at Pelvis NYC. But there was one case 2 years ago that I did miss, and a patient came in. He already went to three urologists. So I just assumed he was already screened. And I mean, I remember him sitting down in the chair. We have like an evaluation chair so people are comfortable. And he sits down and he's like, now I'm just thinking this is like muscular tension. Again, I'm getting into the physical therapy realm here. But he had a slight fever of like 100. He had all the I guess signs of an infection, but I was like, he was just the urologist yesterday with the same symptoms. So I was like, oh, maybe he's going through a flu or something. I was like, let's just do a few sessions, let's say a day. I think he saw me on Wednesday. I saw him on Friday again. And on Friday, he didn't feel any better. Usually by one session, they're able to feel some sort of relief. So I referred him out to a urologist that I know, and he had an active infection. He was the 5 to 10% of patients that actually do have bacterial prostatitis. And he took a course of antibiotics and it got better. But 95% of the cases are chronic non-bacterial prostatitis.
So that brings up a great point, which is what is your role and what is my role in the evaluation of these patients? Because we rarely, if ever, have that discussion. So maybe I'll have you start. What do you think the role is of a urologist? What should we be ruling out? And then I'm going to kind of chime in and tell you what I think I should be ruling out. And then I'm going to say what I think your role is. And then I want you to say what your role is.
This is where it gets really tricky because we almost have to work together. But the question is, when does a urologist, because you're probably the first line, now it's starting to change where people Google their symptoms, like I might need a pelvic floor therapist. But let's just say in the traditional realm, the PCP refers to the specialist, which is you. At what point are you like, well, this is pelvic floor versus something that we can treat? And that's where I'm like, I'm not really sure yet. And I'll tell you why, because how many of your patients are actually of a bacterial cause, like for flow or some sort of obstruction? I have yet to find many of our patients who go to urologists and they find something anatomically wrong, perhaps a urethral stricture, perhaps a bacterial cause. Yeah, I find that most urologists, I mean, the ones that are practicing 1970s medicine, what they do is they correlate some of the symptomology that an older male would have to a younger male and just say, well, take some Flomax. This is probably a bacterial prostatitis. So I think if you see a healthy male in front of you, I mean, I don't think you should be doing some diagnostic testing unless this has been going on for X amount of time. But yeah, it blurs the line. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm
So
really not sure.
let me chime in here. So I think my role as a urologist when someone comes in with like pelvic floor dysfunction symptoms, like you mentioned, whether it's tip of penis pain, testicular pain, burning with urination, is I want to make sure they don't have an infection, which oftentimes I'm not the first urologist they're seeing. So like you, oftentimes they've seen other urologists before, they haven't made progress, and so they eventually end up like in my office. So oftentimes they've already had the urine samples performed. But if they haven't, I'm going to check a urinalysis, I'm going to check a urine culture just to make sure. But
Sure.
it's so rare that I find that. I think after, over the last several years of seeing hundreds of patients, I've seen one guy who had an infection.
Right.
Actually, no, I misspoke. Two guys that had an
Well, you
infection.
have to do your due diligence, of course, from a liability perspective as well, right?
Yeah. And even if they have an infection, they could also have pelvic floor dysfunction because the infection can then induce a pelvic floor. So it doesn't mean, like you mentioned, we found it. It means you have to treat the infection and then see if there are lingering pelvic floor issues.
Sure. And to add to what you're saying, I feel like it's important to have that objective testing, not only from to kind of differential diagnosis perspective, but also from the patient's perspective. What happens is with a lot of these chronic patients is they're like, well, I didn't fully exhaust the urological option, so maybe I need to go back and find other practitioners. I would rather them go with one, do all the testing if possible, and then this way they're totally convinced. They're like, oh, this is a pelvic floor problem. Because the anxiety starts to kick in, and then you start to play doctor or Google yourself, and you can go down a slippery slope that way.
Yeah.
So I would rather them know that the testing was done, and they can rule that out.
Yeah. And then, the additional testing that I'll do really depends on like how obvious their symptoms are when I, how much I really think it's pelvic floor. I'll get a urine flow. I use a company called Amonoflow, which the person just downloads the app on their computer. They give the app access to their microphone, and when they urinate, the urine needs to hit the toilet water and it graphs their flow for me.
No way.
So freaking helpful to get objective urinary flow data when the person is at their home. Otherwise, you bring a person in, right? You expect that they're coming in with a full bladder. You have them go to the bathroom and on demand pee into a funnel.
Yeah, and what do you
Here's what
find?
the urine
Do most
flow
people
looks like
can't
in the
even pee?
office.
Do most people they have they probably can't even pee.
Well, I mean, a lot of them can, but if there's not a lot of urine in their bladder, it's not like super helpful. And it doesn't tell me why they're experiencing these symptoms when they're at home. So one measurement, like one blood pressure measurement, when you go to a doctor's office and you see the white coat, will drastically change the blood pressure in a lot of people, right? So I like using at-home monitoring whenever I can, and I like different data points during the day, during night, because we know pelvic floor symptoms can vary during the day and night. So I want to see both. So in a lot of people, I will check a uroflow, because then if they have a nice bell-shaped curve, that is reassuring to me. That tells me they don't have a urinary stricture or a urethral stricture, right? Now, if they have like what we call like a bread loaf on their tracing, that signifies could be a stricture, and then I'm going to work them up for a stricture. I've seen one guy who had testicular pain. I recall he had like some testicular pain like after voiding. And so I ended up scoping him, and he had a stricture that was causing like this, you know, if you have scar tissue in the urethra and it's ahead of the ejaculatory, you know, duct, and that can push urine, you know, back into the testicles and cause like a chemical irritation. So, you know, the testicular pain and urethral stricture can definitely happen, but it's pretty rare, right? So my job is to make sure, check a urine flow, make sure it looks like a nice bell-shaped curve. That kind of gives me some reassurance. And then imaging is going to be variable. You know, you cannot put a price on peace of mind. So
Sure.
if someone has never had imaging, why not? We are so often taught in medicine that we need to be cost conscious. And yes, we do, right? We're taught that MRIs are very expensive. No, they're not. No, they're not. They can be very expensive, right? If you go to a big center and they have the huge facility fee associated with it. But I work with community centers where there are imaging centers that have a cash rate that's $400 for an MRI, right? No radiation. So I'm very quick to order some imaging because why not have a baseline? It's probably not going to show me why they're causing pain, but it's going to rule out some scary things and give that person peace of mind.
And the white coat syndrome you're talking about for taking blood pressure is so relevant to when it comes to this uroflow test in-house. What happens is most of these guys, and this is what I hear from my patients, they flood their body with a crap load of water before they get in there. Then now they have to perform because now there's testing on how they're going to pee, but they're already kind of like insecure about how that's going to work. So that's a real thing. And by the way, that's incredibly progressive that you've just mentioned that because I've never heard a urologist talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm all about wearable devices, right? And there's a lot of very significant decisions that we make clinically based on bad data
Yeah.
or single time point data points, which is inherently flawed, right? And then, you know, when it comes to the role of a pelvic physical therapist, you know, yeah, we definitely work hand in hand. I think I work with a lot of pelvic physical therapists that would like for some of these things to be ruled out beforehand. And that's kind of where I see my role, just to make sure we're not missing something that honestly could kill the person, right? I think sometimes we're kind of like the emergency room physicians. We may not diagnose something all the time, but sometimes it's to rule out the scary things. And then to make the referral, but also to have that constant communication. I'm always communicating with the pelvic PTs. You know, one of my colleagues reached out to me yesterday and said, "Hey, I saw our mutual patient. She's still leaking urine. When should I send her back to you? Because what I'm doing isn't quite doing the trick."
Right. And so I think that continuity of care is really important. And if both practitioners are willing to work together, then it's a match made in heaven, so to speak, specifically for the patient.
Yeah.
Only going to gain from it. Yeah. And so if most of my patients come in, whether it's on their own accord, I will almost always refer them to a urologist, just to rule stuff out. Just to rule stuff out. It's important. It's really important. There's many things that are not within my scope of practice and wheelhouse, and I think many physical therapists need to understand that and just work together. That's all it is. We all just want the best for the patient.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about tip of penis pain.
Sure.
Why might a man have this?
So it's a great question. To say that I had a specific answer for you, that's difficult. My hypothesis is that chronic clenching of the pelvic floor muscles, specifically the bulbospongiosus ischiocavernosal muscles, will cause that burning, that tip of the penis pain. And what's interesting is that a lot of them mention is like the meatus gets red, and they're like, how is this possible if this wasn't a bacterial issue? Well, you get irritation of the inside of the urethra from all the pressure of those muscles squeezing. So you could also get the pseudo feeling of needing to micturate or urinate. And so it throws people off of it. But I think it's really just like chronic clenching of the perineal muscles that are causing.
There's a really good video that a pelvic floor physical therapist did specifically on tip of penis pain, and she describes, you know, branches of the pudendal nerve and how that can radiate pain to all sorts of areas. And sometimes it could be the way that someone masturbates and putting stretch on a branch of the pudendal nerve, which I also think is interesting. But tip of penis pain can be one of the most devastating symptoms that someone comes in with, because oftentimes they've gone through this whole workup, they've been scoped, everything is coming back as negative. But I send all those guys to pelvic physical therapy. And we know that in young kids too, young boys can have tip of penis pain when they're constipated.
Correct. That was just really cool. It almost points to that is it, pelvic floor dysfunction. Because most of these kids are having it when during like bouts of chronic constipation.
An increasing number of young men with erectile dysfunction. From your perspective, what is the role of a pelvic physical therapist in the treatment of these young men with ED?
Sure. So first of all, you kind of act like a sex therapist in many regards, because you're like, well, what's going on? And, you know, sometimes these men have their erection is just not optimal. They're like at 80%. So we've spoken about this before. It's kind of like when I went through it and I would tell the doctor, I was like, hey, my erection's at 80%. And they'd be like, but you could use it, right? And I'm like, yeah, but it's not where it was before. And I'm not an 80-year-old dude. Like, I'm a young guy, right? So it could be that. It could be that the erection just doesn't work at all. And but the one question that I like to ask him is, what happens when you masturbate? And if some of them tell me like, oh, it's totally normal, then I know there could be a psychosomatic component mixed with maybe some sort of hard flaccid or pelvic floor dysfunction. If we know it totally doesn't work, it hasn't worked for a couple months, they're talking to me about being tired and libido's down. I mean, depending on the age, could this be a hormonal issue that I would refer out to? But from my perspective, I think most of these guys have really tight lower abdominal walls. So is that a perfusion issue, is where the muscles kind of get tangled up in the fascia? Can we get the bulbospongiosis to kind of tone down a bit so you don't get any retrograde flow out of the penis during tumescence? Is that possible? We'll see. Most of these patients do get better, though. But if you give them kind of like the space for them to speak, that already kind of tones them down a bit. Most of these doctors are not giving them the time of day.
So I'm going to be recording a video in the very near future on how a urologist should address young men with ED. Mm-hmm. Do you think that all young men with ED should see a pelvic physical therapist to see if there's a pelvic floor dysfunction component?
I think so. But the other question is, why is this happening in such a rapid fashion into 2025? Like, what? I don't remember this being a thing when I was young. I'm 35 now. I just don't, like, or people maybe didn't talk about it. Has pelvic floor dysfunction been grown just because of kind of the knowledge around it? Or has it always been a thing? I'm not sure. That's where I'm like, or has it been kind of like the companies like Hims or all these other companies that are pushing all these ED medications? So we want everything fast and furious, so to speak, right? And we want it now. And I don't know, are people actually taking the time to like get to know their partner in front of them and really be aroused by the situation versus like, I need to get hard right now? That's all. There's a component to that. I will say that, you know, most of the men I speak with, they're always in their head. So if they're in a group of guys and every guy just assumes that the guy next to them is Lex Steel, so to speak. That was like a porn star from the early 2000s. And every guy just assumes that like, every other guy has an erection that's above 6 inches and lasts 47 minutes in bed. And the truth is, like, your average penis size is 5.3 inches, I believe. Your average man, this is debatable, lasts like 3 to 5 minutes. And that's about it, right? And like, most people are like, let's get some heat after. It's not that serious. So talking through that really helps some of our patients.
So are those some of the things that were going through your head, like when you were going through these issues a few years back?
Yeah,
I mean, sharing a lot of what you were going through with other men and what you thought their experience was.
Yeah, again, like, yeah, so the ED wasn't as big of an issue, but like some of the premature ejaculation was, and then you kind of get in your head. Now, I was someone who engaged in sexual activity early on, so I knew what all of this was supposed to feel like. So it's not like this was like some like adolescent psychosomatic issue. This was like I was good and then I wasn't. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense intuitively. And then when I hung around other men, or, you know, you watch TV and you see this good looking guy and I'm like, he doesn't have a pelvic floor dysfunction. Why do I have one? Mm-hmm. He starts getting your head. It starts to become a bit OCD. So understanding this is what really makes us different when it comes to our patients, because I can get in their head right away. I've been there, and we've trained our staff to know what that looks like too.
Adam, you shared so much exciting and useful information with us today. If I could give you a megaphone, I don't have a megaphone, but if I could give you one, right? We know this video is going to go viral, so maybe a lot of people will hear it. I want you to verbalize two messages. What is your message to other healthcare providers? And what is your message to young men?
It's not all in your head, that's for sure. You don't need to be shameful about what's going on. You could definitely get help. And just reach out to the correct providers. That's all it is. I mean, pelvic floor therapy is here to stay. It's here to help you. We're just a bunch of guys helping other guys. That's really what this is. And everything and anything is a quality of life issue. Whatever you deem necessary for you to get better, then I want to help you with that. And that's the most important message that I can give through it for sure.
I love that message. What's your message to healthcare providers who, let's say, maybe they don't have their team of pelvic physical therapists helping them?
I think be open to the ambiguity that is pelvic floor. I think it's not 100% where we want it to be. Yes, it doesn't explain everything by research and all that, but we get people better. I think we're not 100% sure how yet. So work with other practitioners that are willing to work with you. At the end of the day, we just want our patients to get better and be a little less dismissive.
I love it. Adam, where can people find you in your practice?
So we are in the heart of Chelsea in New York City. We're on 17th between 6th and 7th. We have a beautiful space here. We treat orthopedics and pelvic floor. It happens to be that 80% of our caseload at this point, or 85, is pelvic floor. But we are in the heart of Chelsea, and we're in Manhattan. So yeah.
Awesome. And can you share your website with the audience?
Yeah, it's pelvis.nyc. And we have a bunch of blogs and stuff that people can read through. And we're always here if anybody wants to just speak to us. We do a 15-minute free discovery call before anyone comes in. And we're here to help.
Awesome. Adam, you're the best. Thank you so much for joining me today on Pearls and Perspectives.
Thank you.